Welcome. So this is our third and final session on this little foray into the area of healing. And today the topic is world healing. Are there ways that we can apply what we've learned about Jesus and healing, Jesus and demon possession, Jesus and that Greek word sozo that means salvation and healing, and then some of the perspectives we've tried to develop, like especially this focus on community healing, that when even though we read a story in the Bible about an individual being healed, a lot of what that looks like is putting that individual back into community. Is there a way then we can draw on that for world healing, the Bible, and ecology? And the description I gave was, our world is ill with a fever. I want to start with a quote from one of my favorite books that I kind of take with me wherever I go. This is by Wangari Maathai. She's the Nobel Peace Prize winner who started this organization in Kenya called the Green Belt Movement, which is restoring the world through tree planting, and they've planted millions and millions of trees. She's now died, but the movement continues. And she has a number of books, but I really like this one. It's called Replenishing the Earth, Spiritual Values for Healing Ourselves and the World. And she really takes this image of healing. She's a Roman Catholic, very wonderful Christian, and she's writing in here about tree planting and the crisis of deforestation in Africa and other places and the whole sort of global ecological crisis. She's really good on, she uses the manna story when people are craving, you know, for meat. Here they've been liberated from Egypt, you know, well, we're going to hear at the hike house tomorrow, they get water from the rock in the desert, they get manna, but they're craving. And she uses this image of craving, I think, very powerfully to talk about our culture and the illness that we suffer from, which is a spiritual illness as well as materialism gone nuts. And, of course, in Africa, it's a lot of multinational corporations doing terrible things. But here's what she writes. Well, a certain tree, certain forest or mountain, itself may not be holy. The life-sustaining service it provides, the oxygen we breathe, the water we drink, these are what make existence possible. And from this point of view, the environment becomes sacred. It's because of this connection that people who are religious should be closest to the planet and in the forefront of recognizing that it needs healing. So obviously in Jesus' time, well, I shouldn't say obviously. Actually, there are a number of textbooks now that I use. I'm teaching a class. Sorry. Excuse me. You can see how good I am at technology, okay? Okay. Really? I'm just like, fish it up through my clothes. I do that in private, generally. when I've been on TV, you know, they tell you basically take off your clothes and stick your microphone up through here, but okay. So there are a number, I'm teaching a class this fall on apocalypse and ecology, and we look at a couple new books out, one by a guy named Donald Hughes on environmental problems of the Greeks and Romans. And in the ancient world, there was a lot of environmental destruction, even though it's not of the scale of, you can't have a mine like this. But they did mine copper in the ancient world, and they had problems with toxic runoff from mines. One theory for why the Roman Empire fell is lead poisoning, you know, because all their pipes for water were made out of lead. So they had a lot of environmental problems just on a smaller scale. So certainly the biblical authors are aware of some level of ecological destruction. Probably most famously would be the Cedars of Lebanon that you've got going way back to the Phoenicians. So several thousand years before Christ, already everybody in the ancient world knew how great those cedar trees were on Mount Hermon and up on the high hills of Lebanon, and started cutting them down. And then one of the great deforesters was King Solomon of Israel, who made a trading agreement with King Hiram that he would send conscripted laborers from Israel up to Lebanon to log those trees, and then they'd send them down, and Israel would trade away its grain and agricultural products in return for these big trees. So there was awareness of deforestation, the siltation it caused in some of the harbors. For example, if you've been to Ephesus in Turkey, for example, has anybody been to Ephesus? It used to be on the sea. Now where is it?
Gosh, inland 5 or 10
Yeah, probably miles. 5 miles maybe. But yeah, that harbor silted up during Byzantine times because of so much deforestation and, you know, other things, earthquakes and such too. But so we can't say the biblical authors are, you know, environmentalists like today's authors. But I do make the case that the author of the book of Revelation, for example, John of Patmos, when, especially in chapter 18 of Revelation, when he's describing the toxic economy of the Roman Empire, and he's got this cargo list of 20-some items that he sees on the ships, and he includes logs from the trees of Africa, horses, grain, other things. I think he's got an awareness of how these products coming into the harbor of Ephesus are devastating far-off lands, and that this is a problem that God wouldn't like. You know, it's not just let's go slaughter the trees and cut everything down. I think, and most of all, it becomes also a critique of slave trade. He's got the last items in the cargo list being slaves, that is human lives. So he's, I think, aware, as our other biblical authors, a scholar at Garrett Seminary named Robert Jewett has argued that that's some of what's going on in Romans 8, the groaning of creation, that the author Paul is actually aware of environmental kind of groaning that's going on in the Roman Empire, but nothing of the scale of today. But the question then is, can we apply biblical insights about sickness and illness and maybe even demon possession? I mean, if this craving idea, maybe we could say we've been possessed by a certain craving for more that has taken over our lives. Is that a demon that needs to be cast out? What are ways we can use the healing traditions of the Bible to speak to the climate crisis and the environmental crisis today? And I'm going to bring in a couple Lutheran theologians. This book is on the, don't tell me I forgot it, on the teaching faculty book list, and we probably should have ordered it for the store, because this is the one I'll be drawing on somewhat, and then Jim Martin Schramm, when he comes back later in the summer, will use it also. Eco-Reformation, Grace and Hope for a Planet in Peril, edited by Jim Martin Schramm and Lisa Dayhill. And a number of us have essays in here. I have one on apocalypse and preaching, but the one I really want to draw on is by Anna Vegan, because she's doing a public health reading of the climate change crisis, and then she's looking at Luther's theology. So she's a Lutheran ethicist, and how can we draw on Luther's theology? She does it in some very interesting ways. And then also Cheryl Peterson at Trinity Seminary has a reading of Luther's atonement theory that draws on healing images, and atonement as healing rather than just sort of forgiveness and other things that we've looked at. So there's lots of ways. I mean, we talked yesterday about the healing metaphors extend all through Scripture. Language of healing is a way to talk about the Exodus, liberation, and others. But what I want to underscore, first of all, with talking about ecological healing and world healing, is it's not just the idea of illness. If you apply it ecologically, it's not just metaphorical, it's actual. It's actual disease. In fact, the British medical journal, The Lancet, was the first to come out with this idea, I think, in 2009. They had a special issue of their medical magazine, you know, that doctors subscribe to, that said climate change is the most urgent public health crisis the world faces. And then soon after that, the Journal of the American Medical Association came out with the same thing. So these are doctors, nurses, medical professionals who are saying climate change poses a very great danger to your health. So how is it? Well, as Anna Vegan says in here, and we'll talk about it, there's three basic ways, analogous to what she calls the three C's. I didn't even know about this, but the three C's that you normally talk about are cancer, coronary heart disease, and cholesterol. Is that right? Anyway, but the climate change, three big ones, how they're going to be so dangerous to your health are thirst, that is all water issues, hunger, food issues, and bugs. That is the epidemics, the pandemics that are coming our way as a result of this. So I'm going to just do the bugs as an example here, but then extrapolate to water crisis things, you know, depletion of aquifers, and then hunger would be the huge shifts in countries in most of the world that don't have irrigation, and what it's going to do to food production. But here's stuff. Here's a quote. Okay, so this is a quote from Epstein. I forgot his first name. A wonderful book. He taught at the Harvard Medical School, and he recently died, but he was a public health expert epidemiologist, and he wrote a book called Changing Planet, Changing Health, based on the work he had done first as a Jewish volunteer in Mozambique and a couple other countries, and then based on his work at Harvard Medical School on cholera. And he calls it an epidemic of epidemics. As he says, 40 new diseases have surfaced worldwide since 1976. So precisely at the time that you were talking about, Melissa, yesterday, that most of our diseases have become kind of the chronic diseases, and we thought we had infectious diseases licked, at least according to Epstein, no, we're seeing a new rise of new infectious diseases, and he's attributing it to factors related to climate change. Here's the quote. And not only that, of course, you can't oversimplify it. Here's the quote, though, from Epstein. After 1976, 40 diseases new to medicine surfaced, including HIV, AIDS, Ebola, and a new hantavirus. Other long quiescent diseases like cholera resurged and spread, as I had witnessed in Mozambique. The resurging infectious diseases began invading every medical practice. Why? In the middle of an epidemiological transition to diseases of affluence, that's what he calls these chronic, is that what you call them, diseases of affluence? That would be the cholesterol, cancer. And
so the westernized countries are mostly dealing with diseases of affluence and the less westernized countries, but the diseases of affluence are also invading countries that are dealing with an infectious disease. So yeah, I should have clarified.
And the bugs are coming our way. Yeah, that's what he's saying. Okay. Yep. So why, in the midst of this epidemiological transition to diseases of affluence, are microbes reasserting themselves? And he goes on to say, he draws on some cholera research done by a researcher at the University of Washington, Rita Caldwell, that shows, I mean, it's a complex set of situation of factors that lead to any pandemic, you know, like the bubonic plague in the Middle Ages and stuff. It's social structures falling apart. It's when there's poor people. But Rita Caldwell showed that dormant cholera bacteria in the ocean become active again when ocean temperatures rise, and that was really important to research. So this is, I'll just read this little section from Epstein here, an epidemiologist in the public health part of Harvard Medical School. My experience confronting cholera in Mozambique made me particularly curious about the latest Latin American epidemic. This is in 1991, a devastating cholera epidemic in Peru, in a port city near Lima. I soon came across the groundbreaking research of Rita Caldwell, a tenacious and innovative microbiologist. Oh, sorry, it's the University of Maryland. Oh, here, I put her out here in Washington. Cholera epidemics waxed and waned, raging some for years, then disappearing. Where did the cholera bacteria hide between outbreaks? What was the reservoir? From the beginning, clues pointed to the sea, and then it talks about her research. They actually got people to swallow, under controlled circumstances, these dormant cholera bacteria, and sure enough, they would... Oh, now she's at the University of Washington. For her doctoral research at the University of Washington in the early 1960s, Caldwell had studied the salt requirements of several bacteria. Anyway, so goes on to show basically that cholera is resurging now in the world because open ocean temperatures are warming, and this will be, you know, Bangladesh, all over the world in the tropics, we will start to see this more and more. Now, lest you say, well, fortunately, I don't live in the tropics. Some of the other land diseases, like Zika, malaria, and others, are coming further and further north with warmer temperatures. Mosquitoes are extending into regions once too cold for them to survive. Maybe you've seen this also with Lyme disease, but there's other vector-borne diseases as well. Just a story about malaria. I was with the Lutheran World Federation at a couple of the United Nations climate conferences in Copenhagen and then two others after that. But one of the members of our team was from Lutheran World Service in Tanzania, a guy named Emmanuel. And he told about, he was giving testimony about how growing up in Tanzania, he's from the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro, east of Arusha. And so they had never had mosquitoes in their village. But he said in 1984, when I was being confirmed, one of the kids in my confirmation class got malaria and died. And that was the first that mosquitoes had come to our village. And now they're definitely there and going further and further up in terms of elevation, and then also, of course, further and further in terms of latitude. Let me tell you about just one more. This is one that my husband and I heard about with great concern, called chikungunya. Has anybody heard of this one?
Yeah.
You have? Man, it's really scary. Okay, we heard about it from a guy that we that taught up here in Holden several years ago. Well, actually, I guess it was 2002. Anyway, Philip Moat, who at that time was at the University of Washington, now he's the Oregon State climatologist, and he's talking about chikungunya, and we're like, what's that? Okay, so just so you know, here it is from Wikipedia. You know, my research assistant, Mr. Google, as Marty says. Okay, chikungunya is an infection caused by the chikungunya virus. Symptoms include fever and joint pain, headache, muscle pain, joint swelling, and a rash. Most people are better within a week. However, occasionally the joint pain may last for months, and there's a risk of death. The very young and the very old and those with other health problems are at most risk. While the disease typically occurs in Africa and Asia, outbreaks have been reported in Europe and the Americas since the 2000s. In 2014, more than 1 million suspected cases occurred, including in Florida and the continental United States. So here it is. And then you all know about Zika. I mean, this is just absolutely terrifying. Imagine having to counsel women, don't get pregnant, you know, because this is dangerous. And these are vector-borne illnesses that are climate-related in, you know, maybe indirect but also direct ways. So I think as we talk about health, you know, I want to use it metaphorically also, you know, spiritual health, everything else. But just to say, first and foremost, the reason we need to be thinking about world healing for our planet is because people are getting sick. And the great injustice of climate change is it hits the poorest people, those who did the least to cause the problem. I mean, people who, you know, hardly ever burned a fossil fuel in their life, they're the ones really, really suffering. And the people who did the most to cause it are the most sort of shielded from the effects of it. So that's where this whole idea that, you know, the kind of moral causality of illness that the film people talked about it, this is absolutely false as far as climate illness, because the if you can say, you know, it's the consequences of sin or something, well, the people who sinned the most, that is, the fossil fuels are causing it, are not the ones who are paying the penalty for this. It's somebody else bearing our sins, and it's incredibly unjust. In fact, Larry Rasmussen, who's coming up here in August, I think, when he does talks about climate change, he'll put up in the front of the room 3 empty chairs just to underscore that there's people who aren't with us. And one of the chairs is for the poor. One of the chairs is for all of nature, you know, every other species, the mother and her 2 fawns here that you see walking around the village eating our flowers, and all of the rest of nature, the trees, everything. And then the 3rd empty chair is for future generations, because it's our kids and grandkids who are really going to be paying the price for the effects of, that's how the half-life of carbon dioxide is so long, that it's what was emitted 2 or 3 generations ago is what we're now experiencing. It has that kind of lag time. So, but I do want to say, healing is possible. And that's why I think it's really important to think about how to use this frame of sickness and healing. Because it's easy to talk about ecological problems that we've wrought in terms of sin. Clearly, there's sin. I mean, no question there. But that does not, climate researchers, there's this Yale Climate Project, this guy named Anthony Lazarevitz, who does research on what messaging speaks to people. And the most effective is to frame it in terms of health, with Americans at least. That Americans might not want to repent of sin that much anymore, you know. A few of us, okay. But even I will confess, you know, when I'm not leading the worship service, sometimes I go late to get there after the confession of sin, you know? So, okay, I can see you're horrified. okay, yes, it's great to confess our sins, and it certainly is a sin. But the frame that apparently is the most convincing to most Americans is to say, you've got a health problem. You are ill, and there is healing. We can help you find, well, I shouldn't say a cure, because we talked about the difference between cure and healing. But there are ways to take this on and improve your health. People want to improve their health, right? And live longer and everything like that. Okay, so that is what I want to talk about today, is not to dwell on the problem, but just to say, to frame it as a health crisis, I think, and then look at all kinds of resources from whatever field you're in. And I think I put in on the description on the board, you know, what are your world healing strategies? I think one of the most hopeful and exciting books to come out is this one and this whole project called Drawdown, edited by Paul Hawken. And Katie, our food environmental science teacher, is going to talk about this book also, I think, in her talk tomorrow. But this is the idea that, okay, so let's admit it, we are ill with a fever. The carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere at the time of Martin Luther, you know, and anybody in the Bible, so Old Testament, New Testament, Luther, anybody before the Industrial Revolution, it was 280 parts per million. But in the last 400 years, 300 years, since we started burning coal, we're now up over 400 parts per million. And that's everywhere in the world now, the whole year round. It used to be, you know, it's creeping up. It's this graph that looks like this. You know, you've probably seen it. And they take the measurements on Mauna Loa in Hawaii. Is that where the volcano is? I don't think so. I haven't been there. But anyway, there's an observatory where they actually measure what the carbon dioxide is. And it goes in the, because most of the land with the trees in the world is in the northern hemisphere, and the trees are sucking in carbon dioxide during the summer. So it spikes down during the summer and then up during the winter like this. But of course the southern hemisphere has trees that are at a different time. But anyway, we're up, up, up. And now we've crossed 400 parts per million. This is a dangerous threshold. It's like your blood sugar. I don't know what number would be bad for blood sugar.
You want it under 100.
100 what?
You want it between 70 and 100.
Some things.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think what the unit is.
So what if you had 400? That wouldn't be good, right?
Yeah.
Then you'd need to do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or, you know, so these are analogies, of course, but it's like that. We are spiking dangerously up above 400. We need to get it down, you know, in the range of, well, Bill McKibben says 350. But what this book talks about is not only, okay, so we have to not only quit burning fossil fuels as quickly as we can, you know, go on a diet, a big diet. And the amazing thing now technologically, I mean, I don't know what you think about Al Gore, but his newest movie is all about the latest technology in terms of battery storage that makes, I mean, if we do shift totally to wind and solar, which is not that hard. You know, now the newest wind turbines don't even have blades on them. It's phenomenal. Then the battery storage now is so cheap that this becomes cheaper than any other way of constructing a new electricity generating plant. If your municipal power company tries to tell you they need to build a nuclear plant or even a gas plant, tell them, don't be wasting my money that way. I want the cheapest possible electricity you can generate. And right now, we cross that threshold. You know, the magic, it's like when water passes below 32 degrees, it's past the threshold, it's going to freeze. That's where we are at in terms of solar or wind being cheaper than anything else. So don't let your utility board tell you they've got to build another fossil fuel plant. They don't. But anyway, so we have to stop burning fossil fuels. We can do that pretty... I don't even talk about sacrifice anymore because it doesn't look like it's going to have to be that painful if we just would go ahead and, you know, move that way. I mean, unless you have something against driving an electric car, but the minute you get in one, as Phil Mote, I loved it, Phil Mote, the guy, the climatologist that was the one that taught me about chikungunya, he said to me, and he's Presbyterian, he goes, Barbara, if you want to get men to come to church, have an energy fair, get those Volt and Bolts out there, open up the hood, it's a guy magnet. And so, okay, if you want to get men to come to church. And if, I don't know if you've ridden those cars, they're peppy, they're fun. It's not a sacrifice to ride in a Tesla, okay, you know? So it's you know, we can do it, but we just have to do it. And the longer we wait, the more drastic the tapering off is going to have to be. But this book, Drawdown, what I love about it, and you can do it with your groups in your town, it's 100 ways to reverse global warming. That is, not just to stop it, but to reverse it. And that is to draw down carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And it's phenomenal, all the techniques they have. And so it's not those ones like in that movie Geostorm. Have you seen that one on the airplane? It's really terrifying. And you know that. Yeah. But no, this one is this idea. So geoengineering, we also do not want that. Geoengineering is this, I think it's the cynical way for businesses to make money on global warming as well. I mean, wait long enough and then say, oh, we can't address it through normal means, so we have to shoot up these things into the sky, you know, like particles and very scary things, or salt the oceans with iron filings and things like that. We've got to do more global dimming. That's geoengineering. But in fact, that's not the kinds of things being proposed in here. A lot of it is agriculture, to shift to more sustainable agriculture, and not only that, but do things like biochar, where you would burn agricultural wastes not to ash but just to the level of charcoal and then bury it, which is what it turns out the ancient cultures in the Amazon basin did. And they make this beautifully rich soil, they've over the hundreds and hundreds of years, called terra preta, that is really thick soil that's kind of a combination of the laterite soil and carbonized charcoal. I mean, I don't know enough about it, but it's that caused the Gaia hypothesis guy. What's his name? In Great Britain. Oh, man. He used to be a very strong kind of pessimist about, can we solve global warming? And his answer was no. But then when he discovered the power of biochar and how you really can sequester so much carbon dioxide, now he's changed his mind, and now he thinks it truly is possible. So it's, I mean, it's interesting. The things they look at in here that have the most impact aren't necessarily the things you think. One is being much more careful with refrigerants, for example, because the chlorofluorocarbons of refrigerants are such potent greenhouse gas. In fact, they say that is number one. And then other people, you can go on the Drawdown website, other people say, well, no, that's not the most important one. But they also say that educating women and girls is the second most important, you know. So it's worldwide, direct and indirect things, but a lot of it is agricultural. Pasture cropping, where you plant trees along with pasture. Marine permaculture, silvopasture, microbial farming, other things. Oh, industrial hemp. Interestingly. But anyway, smart grids, a lot of electric grid kinds of things, a lot of looking at indigenous cultures and how they've done agriculture and things like that. Oh, another one is much better cook stoves in third world countries, so they're not burning so much charcoal for fuel. So it's easy stuff that if we started to implement it on a global scale, you really would be able to draw down the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere down below 400, and then down below that, and then down to 350 to a safer level. Huh, Glenn?
I was just curious if, in fact, my son-in-law asked me this. You know, we took the operations tour, and of course, at this time of year, Holda's able to generate power that we don't need, and then in the wintertime, it's hard to generate enough. And you asked, well, what about battery technology? Where would that be, you know, and costs and all that kind of stuff? And you brought up battery technology as one of those many options. Has Holden ever talked about it?
Huh,
I mean, I don't know the cost for it. I don't, you know.
Wow, interesting. I don't know. We have
like
to ask
a question for the SciTech.
Yeah, because actually some of the, if size doesn't matter, which at Holden, I mean, this is gigantic. So what they're thinking, I mean, you know, these are wild ideas that I read about in my science magazine. And, you know, I'm a subscriber to science, so a little bit of science knowledge is dangerous. But, you know, every week new things come out. But that if size doesn't matter, you know, because the Tesla batteries are those wall-mounted ones, which, you know, are fine in your garage and stuff. But they're even saying that we all could have sort of in our basements like the size of two hot water tanks kind of thing. And one is a, you know, it'd be like the two poles of a battery where during the day when you're generating solar and, you know, electricity, then you'd go, I don't know if it's positive, negative, what, I'm sorry, I'm terrible on electricity. But anyway, you'd get that one tank all, you know, whatever it is. Let's say it's positive. And then during the night or whatever, you know, so you'd be able to draw on that. So, you know, because there's all kinds of ways to do batteries that are pretty low tech but might be large but not very expensive.
Right.
So,
and third world countries, I know, are looking into better technology because maybe it's more affordable.
Yeah.
And wherever they are, out in the midst of nowhere, you know, they can use it.
Yeah, and if they can leapfrog over having to have an electric grid even, that saves so much money. Like, same thing with phones. If they don't have to go the landline route at all but can just go to satellite phones, it's saving so much. So just to say, I think we live, you know, at a terrible moment right now when the... I'll just read from Anna Vegan, and then this will be, you know, we all know how bad things are, but okay. So we wrote this book a couple years ago to get ready for the 2017 anniversary. So I think it was published in 2015 or maybe 16, you know, when we thought we were...
Which book?
This one, Eco-Reformation. I have a chapter in there in Anna Vegan, but I'm going to read from her chapter. Come on, where is it? Oh, Barbara Rossing, where are we? Okay, here it is. Climate change came home to roost in 2015. 2015 is the year it finally became untenable to ignore or deny outright the fact of climate change, both in the United States and across the globe. Well, guess that was temporary. Okay. But she points out that was the year that Pope Francis's encyclical Laudato Si came out. And if you haven't read that, I highly recommend it. I mean, we're coming up next week on the third anniversary of that wonderful letter. Basically, it's a love letter by Pope Francis and a whole team of scientists and others that helped write it. But our book group in Leavenworth studied it, a joint Roman Catholic Lutheran book group, and it was lay-led, and we took turns, you know, looking at chapters and stuff, and it was just wonderful. And as one of our Forest Service people said, this Pope is both a poet and a scientist. He's got it all right. And he is a scientist. He was a chemistry major as an undergraduate, you know, and then switched to religion. But he's also got such beautiful imagery in there. So that was 2015, and it makes for a great ecumenical study to do that. But it's also the year of the Paris climate talks when we did get a world agreement on doing something about climate change. Every country made voluntary commitments. Of course, the national U.S. government has now pulled out of that, but still municipalities, states, counties can stay in, and in fact there's a whole movement called We're Still In and can uphold those climate commitments. Now, of course, what we need is a price on carbon. That's the big gap still. But this bipartisan in the Congress, the Citizens Climate Lobby, they just got six new people to join, congressional representatives, and it's sometimes called the Noah's Ark lobby. You have to go in two by two. That is, a Republican has to go in with every Democrat. So, you know, more Democrats would like to join, but they have to find themselves a Republican and go in two by two. So more and more Republicans are stepping up on this. Our representative in our district here, David Reichert, is a member, a Republican, Missouri Senate representative. You know, so the more that climate change doesn't become so partisan, but that we can agree, and then just fix it. I mean, it's not that bad. Yes, you might take, there's two possibilities for how you put a price on carbon. Either you do it as a kind of cap and trade, which is fine. That's how we do the Montreal Protocol with chlorofluorocarbons, you know, those refrigerants. Or you do it as a tax, a carbon tax, and then you can rebate the whole thing back to people. We had that on the ballot in Washington a couple years ago. It didn't pass, but it's what conservatives even favor, which is, okay, tax the things that are bad, so don't, you know, Social Security shouldn't be as expensive as it is. Tax the stuff you don't want people to do, and then give it all back to them in some form or another, whether it's, you know, like the Alaska dividend or whatever, you know. So it doesn't mean government has to get bigger. It just means that you put a price on carbon emissions because it's pollution. It's, you know, you don't let dumping of anything else happen for free. The industries have to clean it up. But the problem with carbon dioxide is it's clear. You don't see it. So it doesn't look like pollution, but it is. So anyway, I'm getting into the logistics here, but it's not going to be that hard, I don't think. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think you're touching on the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which, you know, I've been in a lot. We know where our government is and how it's shifted in the last couple of years. For obvious reasons, but you know, I've been in a lot of discussions with friends, a wide variety of friends, and there seems to be two other categories that are really opposed to this. One is, of course, the deniers of climate change. There is no such thing as global warming, and there are fewer and fewer of them. I think we're seeing more and more evidence that's making it difficult for them to hang on to that. But maybe the more interesting one is another category, which I have to find a careful way to describe this, but they're the ones that are kind of cheering this on. And the reason is that, hey, when the world comes to an end, that's when Jesus comes. So, for example, a good high school friend of mine, we were in a conversation about this, and he said, "Ron, the world is meant to burn." And he can't wait for this to happen.
And he's not alone.
Yeah, there are large groups of people.
Yeah, I guess maybe in Ohio it's large, but I would say, you know, Anthony Lazarowitz. thank you, that's very important. The surveys of Americans on climate change would say that he's got the kind of hardcore deniers as only being about 10 or 20%, which still is big, but they sound louder than that. And so he puts most people in some kind of middle, and then the people who are extremely concerned and activists would only be in the 10%. So they do poll people, and then they try to poll them on the messaging too, and that's where I guess I would say, there's people who are sick with, we have a friend who died of colon cancer because she never had a colonoscopy because she didn't want to. Okay, fine. So there are people in that category who, even if they're sick, they won't do anything about it. But most people, if you say, you know, look, you might have a blood sugar problem, but there's ways to manage that, combination of diet, lifestyle changes, some medications, you know, and it's not going to be that terrible. Just like HIV, you know, most people, if you would frame it that way in terms of health, I think would respond. And this is where I guess I think if we show a way of hope, and so that's why it's interesting. I mean, the Scandinavian churches are starting to say, don't talk to kids so much about climate change because it just leads to despair. Before a certain age, we shouldn't tell our children about this. And whenever you do tell people about it, you have to do it in a hopeful way. So this is where I want to help think about how can we mobilize the healing stories in the Bible and help people think about that. And I do think, I would say the church, I think we're going to see too many people jumping from the denial camp over to the despair camp and saying, well, you know, there isn't climate change, there isn't climate, and then suddenly they'll say, well, I guess there is, but it's too late to do anything. And the church and all of us, you know, who care about the world have to open up the wedge between denial and despair and say, no, there's hope. There's all kinds of technology that's not going to be that difficult to implement. There's all kinds of ways we can work on healing the world that aren't hugely expensive. In fact, it's going to be more expensive to stay in denial because, by the way, did you notice, you know, this is when I was driving back to Chicago a couple years ago, did you notice it's burning on both sides of I-90 as I drive through Montana? You know, should I really be driving on this? The wildfires alone. I mean, everything about ignoring climate change is more expensive than dealing with it. Glenn?
I was thinking of, you're talking about awareness of the problem, and does that bring hopelessness? And back in the 60s, 70s, and so forth, they did some testing of younger kids, you know, about threats and worry about nuclear Holocaust stuff. And this notion being, well, let's just not talk to kids about it because then they would become despairing. And then, but the test proved that there were these kids who were hopeful. But why? Because they had parents who were working to make sure there was no nuclear Holocaust.
Uh-huh.
See, so they knew about it, they were aware of it, but they had parents who were going to make a difference.
Okay,
so I
good.
Think that might relate to...
Well, yeah, to draw it out. That's why if you say there's 100 things we can work on, you know, if your congregation doesn't want to work on... biochar, you know, who does? Okay, my husband does, by the way, and I enjoy it too. Okay, but if you don't want to work on that, well, then you can work on refrigerants. So our little group in Wenatchee, our climate group, thought, okay, we're going to work on refrigerants and find out what is our public utility district doing about that, and what can we do about that? If you don't want to work on that, you can work on retrofitting buildings. I mean, there's 100 things you can work on, so just start somewhere, because all of these... This is the research of this guy at Princeton, Sokolow, and somebody else, that there's no silver bullet to address climate change. It's all going to be silver buckshot. That is, it's many, many, many slices of things. So just start working on one of those, and that would maybe help give your kids hope that you can do something. And together, if we each work on our little slice, it'll make a difference. And healing is possible. So let me just go back here, since I'm a theologian, not a scientist. So Anna Vegan talks about how this actually is very Lutheran. And I hadn't realized this, that Luther, in talking about healing as being connected to salvation, the stuff we did yesterday with sozo, is the same with the Latin word salus. So salvation is related to health, salve, you know, and things, poultices come from that. And interestingly, heilung, the German word for healing, is also the same root word as heil or salvation. So as she writes here, these ancient and medieval theological strands run deep in modern Lutheran theology. The ELCA social statement, caring for health, our shared endeavor. I didn't even know we had that. Okay, a couple of years old here. Writes, quote, Heil salvation is intrinsically bound up with healing. No call for reformation is sufficient without it. And so that's why a bunch of us coined this idea of eco-reformation. As we're about the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, and by the way, you might think it was over last year, but as Bishop Guy Irwin pointed out to our faculty when we had him come and speak to us last year, and we're like, oh, we didn't do enough for the Reformation, you know, we missed it. He's like, what do you mean you missed it? 1517 was just the nailing of the 95 Theses. Luther lived another 40 years after that. So if you miss 2017, then do 2020, the Babylonian captivity, which is a really interesting writing of Luther's. You know, maybe we're in a kind of Babylonian captivity in our age. Or you can do the anniversary of the translation of the Bible into the vernacular. There's all kinds of things coming up for the next 40 years that we can think about the Reformation in terms of. So, but the idea of eco-reformation, why we're working this, is that you don't just commemorate the Reformation anniversary looking back and being thankful, you know, that thank goodness we got those Catholics to not be selling indulgences anymore. And at least they believe in salvation through justification by faith. Thank goodness. But no, you look forward, you know, what still needs reforming today? That's one of the Reformation principles of Ecclesia Semper Reformanda, the church always being reformed. What's still to work on? And the Lutheran World Federation Assembly last year had this kind of threefold theme that I really liked. The overarching name of it was Not For Sale. You know, obviously picking up on the indulgences idea. You know, you can't sell salvation, please. And Catholics don't, okay. But under the Not For Sale banner, they had three categories. They had salvation, not for sale. They had human beings, not for sale. And they looked at things like human trafficking and all the ways that we commodify one another. And then the third one was creation, not for sale. And this is this ecological reformation we need, that you have to see Not For Sale as encompassing all of this and work on these things. And I wrote one of the chapters for the Lutheran World Federation study book on that, on creation, not for sale. God saw that it was good. But I do think things are really, really hopeful, and that framing it in terms of healing can help give people energy to work on this, to see that healing is possible. It's like your blood sugar. You don't have to be stuck at 400. There's ways to bring it down, and we can all work on this together in community. It's not too late. And I think that's a really, really important message to share. So let me just read from the Eco-Reformation. No, I'm not going to do that. I want to hear from you. So what are you working on for your world healing strategies, and what is the most compelling for you as you think about this crisis?
Well, I might also plug this book, Apocalyptic Ecology. Mm-hmm. I read the foreword, and that's why I bought the book.
Oh, good. Yes, I was writing that foreword last summer when I was up here in Holden. But yeah, it's really, and I'm going to use it in this class I'm teaching on Revelation now about the Bible. And there's tons of books. I wrote a bunch of books on Bible and ecology because I have to write another chapter. David Horrell, The Bible and Environment, Richard Belcom. One of the leaders is a guy who's taught up here at Holden a whole bunch, Norman Hobble. He's an Australian Old Testament scholar, and he's pioneered the Earth Bible series that many of us from Holden have written in, and I'm going to be writing the commentary in Revelation for that. But yeah, there's all kinds of exciting scholarship on theology and ecology. Cynthia Molibita, who's taught up here, many, many others. And then the work, I mean, I just have to say, Katie's talk on Monday, the stuff she's doing on food waste, that's another big one in here. That's so much, I mean, if food waste is not composted, it goes into landfills, that's a huge contributor to global warming. So all kinds of things you can do with food issues. Whatever issue you want to work on, so many possibilities, and you can learn about many of them here at Holden Village. Uh-huh,
Ann? I think it's, and I'm sure this is many other places in the country, but we, in Minnesota, I mean, the amount of waste we now take to the down to the garbage can is minuscule. Mm-hmm. Because everything is recycled, and including we take our organic waste to a very handy place, not very far from us, and then we pick up this wonderful soil. Mm-hmm. That we then put on our garden. I mean, it's put out in a great big pile. You take it for free. And as it's wow. Very encouraging. I mean, I think you need those mm-hmm. encouragements.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. Now, one of the problems with recycling now is that China's not buying our recycling so much anymore. So a lot of it does end up in the landfills. Seattle's struggling with that. They've got so much recycling, but nowhere to send it. So yeah. On that, we do need to start using fewer containers, fewer
packaging.
Everything. Yeah. I love the way the Holden store has that those giant things of sunscreen. And, you know, if you brought your bottle from home and you ran out, then you just go there and buy an ounce and stuff. I mean, we're going to have to do a lot more stuff like that, because recycling only is helpful if they can actually use it for something. But the soil, that is the perfect example. Thank you.
Yeah.
And churches. I mean, so just to say, your church, okay, so we've talked about healing in terms of eschatology the first 2 days, that what Jesus is doing in casting out demons, you know, the negative, overthrowing the powers of oppression, the Roman Empire, all the manifestations of oppression in people's lives that could be called demons, and he's casting those out, and the kingdom of God is arriving. Time's up. The kingdom of God is here. So it's like the future has come into the present and is overthrowing the evil, and then same thing positively on the healing. The future kingdom of God enters the present, invades the present, as Brian Blunt said, and is doing something already now that is signs of the kingdom of God dawning in the world. So churches, I mean, it's not that churches are going to bring in the kingdom of God. That's the old sort of social gospel idea. You can't say that. But churches can be signs in advance, in the present, right now, of something we believe God is bringing from the future here. So that's why, like, church gardens and stuff can be such great things. Right near the seminary where I teach, the Jewish synagogue has a garden. In fact, it's right across from President Obama's house in a kind of ritzy neighborhood. So some of the people were concerned, ooh, a garden could be kind of ugly. You know, you got your corn plants and, you know, it's going to look like a farm. Do we really want that? So they made the garden, some of it at least, in the shape of a giant Star of David, bigger than this, with the different points of the star having different crops in them and stuff. Very beautiful. So it's like an ornamental vegetable garden. Mm-hmm. And then they pick the vegetables and put them on the altar, on the bima, instead of altar flowers. Mm-hmm. So just, what would that be like in your congregation? So it's these vegetables all over the altar. You go to Shabbat, and it's just beautiful to see these baskets of, you know, red peppers, yellow peppers, green mm-hmm. peppers. But, you know, that is a small thing, but it could be a sign of churches starting to think about, you know, and then you can give the produce to the food pantry or whatever. And then our church in Leavenworth, we did a 96-panel community solar project on the community middle school roof. So everybody sees it. I like to think about it as like Luther's 95 theses plus one. And that one actually was really easy to do, because in Washington State, the incentives are so good that all we had to do was get investors, and they're actually making money. But that's how a community... The idea with this is if enough people invest in solar, then it brings the cost down for everybody else. And indeed, that is the case. That since we built that, well, since Lauren and I built our solar panels, the cost is now about a third of what it was. We had to spend $60,000 at our house for our solar array, but you can get the same thing now for $20,000. That's how you bring costs down. And in Washington State, you get most of that back in the incentive. But that's how Germany's done it, too. They gave people an incentive, and it brings the cost of everything down. So that's why solar is now the cheapest, solar and wind, way to generate electricity in the world. So you have to sort of be living already in the present what you think the future needs to look like, and that's the best sign of hope you can be. So whether it's having chickens at your church, I don't know. We had this guy speak in Chicago about all the stuff they've done at their church. They, you know, get the blower thing, so you try to find out where all the leaks are, and then they patch that. They went to triple pane windows in their parish hall only. I mean, it doesn't make sense in the church, because they said we only use that, you know, Sundays and a little bit more. But like for the air conditioning, they've gone to those mini splits, so they don't air condition up to the ceiling, they just air condition at the level where people are. I mean, it's really interesting. But there's all kinds of stuff you can do in terms of energy in your church that might not be, you might be doing it to embody the future that you want the whole world to go to, and that's really important. Lutherans are all about signs and symbols anyway. You know, that's what Eucharist is, everything. So you point to something that's happening, and you help people realize there is a future of hope. Did you have your hand? Maureen.
I was just going to add, this is, I think, implied by everything you've done is kind of the backstory, but with people are having... struggling to be hopeful about this. You look at Jesus and healing. healed everybody that came to him. People said, don't bother with that girl, she's already dead. He says, no. And that's our sign. You know, that he never gave up on, I can't think of any time when he gave up on healing anybody who came to him. And the woman just touches his clothes. You know, he stops the whole process in order to take care of that healing. And her healing came because she came forward mm-hmm. and did something. And he said, that has made you
yep. well. Her courageous act of trust and faith. Yeah, and that, so that's what we have to be about. I mean, it's easy to despair. Hey, I've despaired already, you know, several times today. But we have to be in community with each other to be the hope. You know, Moses, when his arms got tired, Aaron and the others, they're holding up his arms. We have to do that for each other. This is a tough time, but it's too bad because the technology is really so advanced. It's just unbelievable how much can happen, but we just have to start doing it and believing in it. I mean, and not believing the propaganda that says, the denial machine is funded by rich fossil fuel corporations. We know that. This was a Harvard historian of science. What's her name? The book was in the store. But anyway, it was the same people that funded the tobacco denial industry and kept Americans smoking for another 15 years. Even though the tobacco companies knew that tobacco was causing cancer, they got the denial machine going. And then those very same people transitioned over to working for the fossil fuel companies doing the same thing. The strategy worked the first time. So, what is the name of it? Climate of Denial. No, it's... Yeah, she was at Harvard, now she's in California. But anyway, Ross Gelbstein has shown that too. Many, many people have shown that. So it just means, hey, it's like Bible times. This is why, you know, I work on the book of Revelation. The dragon is going to try to be a deceiver, and it's going to try to deceive the whole world. And don't fall for it. We have to, you know, tell the truth and be witnesses to hope, the truth that is in us, and be the ones who have faith that God still loves the world. God has no plans to give up on the world. I'm sorry, but that theology that says the plan is for the world to burn up, that's based on one verse in 2 Peter 3, and it's a really terrible verse. And I mean, okay, but there's plenty of other verses that have God saying, it's good, it's good, it's very good. God loves this world, and we have to say that. That's John 3:17,
well,
no problem.
So my response to him was, in Genesis chapter 1, if you think that we're here to just consume the planet, you got to read verse 27, mm-hmm. right before that, that says we're made in God's image. Would God do that to the world? No, right? So I think if God cares about the planet, then we should be because we're made in God's image.
Yeah.
It's hard for him to talk.
Right, and I absolutely agree with you. What I have found, though, with my rapture work is I use the work of this guy at the University of Wisconsin, who basically says there's about 20 to 40 million Americans who believe the rapture hardcore, and you're not going to persuade them. But he says around that are concentric circles of people who, you know, so that core can't convince them, even if this guy's your friend. Mm-hmm. But around that, you've got the people that think, oh, wow, okay, I need to believe in that because that's what the Bible says. And then there's people around that, well, it sounds biblical, but okay, sure. But those are the ones that you can persuade. So those really core people that think God's plan is to burn up the planet and it's all prophesied in the Bible, they're wrong. It's not. But you're not going to convince them. So, you know, but work on those other circles. As Anthony Lazarwood says, there's the 60 to 80% in the middle that are persuadable, and he thinks the healing frame is one of the best ways. Interesting, another frame is military, you know, national security, because of course our military thinks that climate change is very dangerous, you know, refugees, everything else. But that frame is not as convincing for people. They're not as scared about their security, or they're not as convinced that that's connected to climate. But health, they want to be well. Everybody wants to be well and as cheap as possible. So,
Mark, over here.
Uh-huh.
Up here.
Oh,
questions over here.
Oh, Gary.
Yeah,
We recently heard her talk by Amory Lovins.
By who?
Amory Lovins.
Oh, Brian, yeah. Lovins, uh-huh.
I mean, he was one of the earliest thinkers about alternative energies. And
he's in Colorado, right?
He's in Aspen. He's convinced that the technology is here. We don't need more technology. He says it's just a matter of design and implementation. And we can do it. And I was really surprised. It was much more of an optimistic from this guy who's sort of a guru in all this than I thought it would be.
What's the if?
The transformation.
The reversal.
The reversal of...
It's amazing. And any, engineer scientist that's really working on it will say that the breakthroughs, just like with cell phones, it happened twice as fast as anybody thought, or computers, anything. The technology happened twice as fast to make it possible. Good. I'm glad you heard him. I'd love to hear him. But yeah, so... And the cost has been driven down too so much. So it's clear. My husband I hope he went to this meeting last night. I didn't ask him, but in Chelan County in Leavenworth about the icicle drainage strategy. But I mean, we've got all these problems with megafires now. But clearly, the cheapest alternative, and Americans should want to save money, is to deal with it now, because the costs of megafires are so much more than everything else. And then, the big one that we haven't talked about here is sea level rise. That is already being felt by a number of U.S. communities. Sadly, it's the most marginalized ones, the ones who did nothing to cause it. But the island of Shishmaref, Alaska, that you might have grown up learning about as a mission field and stuff, that I read an article by the youth leader in Shishmaref Lutheran Church. Esau Sinek is his name. Maybe he's at the youth gathering. I don't even know. But saying, we're going to have to relocate our whole village, very sadly, because the sea ice doesn't form the way it's supposed to, so the whole island is being eroded by these November, December storms. Alaska has had the most terrible temperature increase, climate change, of anywhere in the country. And, to relocate that village, because they're way above the Arctic Circle, it's going to be like hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's just one village of several hundred people. Similarly, in the Gulf of Mexico, the Choctaw village of Isle de St. Charles is an island of indigenous people also that's being submerged. But this is going to happen everywhere. Why not just do something about climate change now? Why not just sequester the carbon now, draw down, and solve this terrible, terrible health problem before we have to move every major city, every major port, every major military base? That's going to be kind of expensive.
Up here.
I'm so sorry. Okay, here I've been talking to you. Okay, you, and then Chuck, and then who else has their hand up? I'm sorry. Please.
Yeah, so I mean, talking about that and...
See, good. This guy knows what he's talking about. Not like you.
And so, you're talking about how, Lutherans, pointing to things and signs and symbols, and people see pictures like polar bears on sea ice that are starving and things like Shishmaref where it's kind of being disappearing into the sea, but those things are things that people see and think, that's sad, but they don't really relate to them because, in a way, it doesn't really affect them. And just like people think, if global warming is happening and the sea level is rising and temperatures are getting warmer, then, it's just warmer oceans, things are okay to swim in, you get nicer beaches and things like that. And it's just like the case of, as you were speaking of, carbon being hard to see, it's kind of hard to comprehend things like increasing ocean acidification and increased ocean temperature. And that, also relates to the bigger problem of people knowing about the problems, but they can't relate or don't think that anything they can do will help. And that relates a lot to, Holden itself is really great for place-based learning and things that we do here. People think you can only do in remote locations like this, but you can do anywhere else, like you're talking about in the drawdown book. And then another you were speaking of, the illnesses that the Earth and the people have due to the increase in temperatures and things like that. And a good kind of analogy and something to visualize it is in terms of fever that you're talking about with a lot of symptoms of these reoccurring diseases, and the kind of science involved with it. So like human body temperature is about 97, 98 degrees. Your body temperature goes up 2 to 3 degrees over 100, and you just feel miserable. And that's the same thing that's happening in the oceans. And I think that's a really good analogy for people to understand that this is the impact that it's having, and it's releasing illnesses to the humans, but also the Earth itself is ill. And there are a lot of things that we can do with these relationships and place-based learnings.
Yeah, let me just say on that one, it's not just a metaphor, though. I mean, even in terms of people's bodies, in Iowa, for example, the temperature has gone up almost 3 degrees, and more people have died of heat stroke and stuff. In Chicago, the one summer I was gone, thank goodness I was here, we had over 500 people die in the heat wave. So it's real death that is happening because of fever. Now, of course, we can mute it with air conditioning and stuff, but that's, you know, it's a wake-up call that somehow, and, you know, just yesterday, Iowa apparently is having all these torrential rains and stuff. A train carrying, I think it was tar sands oil, but definitely oil, derailed and went in the river, and now people's water is being endangered. And this is, you know, somewhat climate related, all these rains and stuff. So we have to just start connecting the dots.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay. And then like telling the truth about climate change in a way that people can understand, because I think there's a big gap between the people that are full on, climate change is happening, it's very severe, and kind of the middle to lower percent that are kind of sort of understanding the process of climate change but have a hard time relating it to things that they understand.
Yeah, and I use that word climate change, but you don't even have to use that word. I went to this congregation in North Minnesota, Nisswa, Minnesota, in a congressional district now that's going to be really up for grabs, and they said, we want you to come and dedicate our solar panel system, and we're going to do a whole energy fair day, and we've got all kinds of water stuff that we want you to talk about. You may not use the word climate change. And I'm like, you're kidding. You know, you're having me here to preach on ecology, eco-reformation. They go, yes. And you're not to use the word climate change because that alienates people. You can say everything you need to say without that. And they're right, you can. You can talk energy conservation, you can talk stewardship, you can talk God's love for the world. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can say it. So thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on to your comment on Shishmaref, because I think Anne Stromgren is still in the village, and she's from Shishmaref.
Huh,
her
okay.
husband is the pastor up there, and I think the story is really important to hear these stories. And I think, so any of you who are interested more about that is to connect with Anne. Anne last night was playing the saw Happy Birthday. Okay, but connect with her, because she's from there, and she'll go as deep as you want to go into the story of what's happening to that indigenous people up there.
Wow.
And how climate's impacting them.
Thank you.
Yes.
Somebody else had
actually, I mine earlier, but it was
I'm so sorry.
Simply a basic favorite healing story, and it's what we do. Girl's dying. They want to bring her to Jesus. They four guys get up and rip the roof off and lower her down in front of Jesus. And for me, it's always been a reminder, you know, one person might go touch him, but sometimes it needs people around it to actually do something. And there's their healing story. So whether we're talking climate change or whichever.
But thank you.
I'm a believer that depression, it means we didn't know what to do. And if you don't want to be depressed, do something. And if you have to go this, like you said earlier, just pinpoint one thing. That does make a difference even in us as we're doing it. So.
Thank you. Yeah, and be smart about it. I mean, so they'll tell you which strategies have the most bang for the buck, and do those first maybe. But yeah, thank you. I think that what is the analogy today of the four people ripping the roof off and lowering somebody down in hope and believing that healing is possible. I think that's the moment we're at right now.
Well, I sing in the back of my mind a Beatles song, of course, with a little help from my friends. So.
I have a good news story from an environmental engineer economist who was working on a project for New Jersey. They want to put windmills out in the ocean, but they're not going to be able to do that until they have to put it on the ballot to make it happen. And what they're using was just amazing to me. They're using virtual glasses, those glasses, because they're gonna, the windmills are gonna be so far out that people won't, they may be able to see them, but that's what the planners are doing. They're giving the virtual glasses out to the population so that they can see what those windmills will look like out there before they vote on it.
Now, I just want to close by, thank you, reading lastly here from Vegan, you know, because we have to get away from this idea. She says, for too long, climate change has been cast as a narrow topic involving tree huggers, environmentalists, the polar bears, like you say. So she uses a definition of health from Emily Towns, an African-American theologian, that talks about this integral idea of health, and including community health, that I think we want to use then to think also holistically and environmentally. Health is not simply the absence of disease. It comprises a wide range of activities that foster healing and wholeness. It is a cultural production in that health and illness alike are social constructs and dependent on social networks, on biology and environment. It is embedded in our social reality. Health also includes the integration of the spiritual, how we relate to God, the mental, who we are as thinking and feeling people, and the physical, who we are biologically. All these aspects of our lives are important. And she cites also the World Health Organization, this determinant, the social determinants of health and how important those are. So I think we as religious people have, you know, deep rooting in this also, that health means the health not just of individuals isolated, but the health of the whole communion of saints and the whole world, that animals and plants and the whole community of the world are in communion with us. Pope Francis coined the term integral ecology in that Laudato Si. So you don't play off the environmental crisis against the social crisis as if, you know, the environment is going to cause lack of jobs or whatever. It's integrated ecology. It's all related. And I think that's the gift the church can bring to this question, and a very important one of thinking of health in an integrated, holistic way. Okay, well, we better stop. Thank you.
Thank you.